I'm psychologist Dr. Michael Broder. We certainly hear a lot about stress these days and the toll it can take on us in virtually every aspect of our lives. In this program, we're going to talk about what stress is, how to manage it, how it can get destructive, and even when it can actually benefit you. Throughout the program, there will be discussion and exercises geared to help you identify and apply the material presented specifically to your life. Toward the end of the program, you'll learn the techniques of breathing, meditation, and relaxation that you can use as tools to quickly manage your stress. In addition, this program will give you a multitude of strategies for coping with the stresses that you've identified as plaguing you. As you listen, you'll find that much of what you hear you'll be able to readily identify with, while a few things discussed may not apply to you at all. So it's important for you to listen to this entire program and keep a pencil and paper handy in order to take note of those items that particularly pertain to you. Also, feel free to stop the tape anytime you need a moment to reflect or to be able to concentrate more fully on the exercises. If you're driving in a car and cannot participate in the exercises presented right now, simply make a mental note to come back to them during your next listening or when it's more convenient. You'll find it most helpful to listen to this program not only once, but often, particularly at those times, and you know when they are, when you can use it the most. The information and exercises that you're about to hear have helped and continue to help countless numbers of people. I hope that you'll find this program to be a constant source of support that's always there for you. It's easy to define stress. Stress is simply the pressure that comes with daily living. That's right. To be alive is to be under some degree of stress. Stress can be generated either externally or internally. How we handle our stress can affect our health more than possibly any other factor. Now, excess stress is what we call distress. And distress is actually the amount of stress over and above that which you can adequately manage or cope with. In actuality, it's distress that studies have shown accounts for anywhere from 50 to 80% of all disease. So no matter how hard we try, we probably can't completely avoid the stress of daily living, but we can learn to reduce stress significantly and also reduce the impact it has on us by learning certain skills for managing and coping with it. This can keep us on the healthy side of that invisible line, which puts us in the potentially dangerous arena of distress. So first, let's get more specific about what stress is, and then we'll get just as specific about things you can do to manage it. And remember this simple equation, that the difference between the amount of stress you're experiencing and the amount that you're able to manage or cope with is your personal level of distress. So our number one goal here is to eliminate distress whenever and wherever possible. As you may see, stress in and of itself can actually be a motivator and a possible source of change and excitement. Aside from genetic factors, the reality that some people are so much better equipped than others to handle stress simply means that their stress management skills are more intact. For example, with a little bit of reframing or redefining, being under stress can be seen as a great way to motivate you, perhaps, to begin and complete a task that you've been putting off. One of the main external triggers of stress is change. This could refer to job changes, such as a promotion, demotion, or transfer, a change in your financial status, such as increased debts, loss of income, or even a substantial increase in income. Family changes, such as marriage or pregnancy, change in family responsibilities, or when someone leaves the house. These things almost always act as stressors. Retirement is a very common stressor, even though the main symptom may simply be boredom, which you might think of as anything but stressful. Nevertheless, it's a change. And boredom is a common antecedent to depression, and depression is quite often an expression of how we feel when we're distressed. For that matter, any lifestyle change, a new relationship or divorce, someone moving into or out of your home, moving your place of residence, changes in the way you spend leisure time, or changes in social activities, all contribute to our reservoir of stress. Also, an illness or injury, sexual difficulties, the illness of a close friend or family member, the death of a loved one, or any other personal loss can all be stressors or sources of stress, then distress. And if you think that's all, even predictable events such as holidays and vacations stress your system. In fact, every holiday season, callers to my radio program want to talk about holiday stress more than anything else. Holiday stress can refer to not having the people in your life that you most associate the holiday with, or having a little bit too many people in your life, all pulling at you at the same time. Of course, any crisis can put you under stress. Even if at the time the crisis occurs, you're not feeling particularly stressed out. In addition, there are numerous ways that we put stress on ourselves. Perhaps you tend to overplan each day, or you engage in so many activities and thoughts at the same time that you overtax your system. Excessive competitiveness, which could include turning almost every situation or encounter into a win-lose situation, even during leisure activities, which are supposed to be relaxing, or the dire need for recognition, along with everything you have to do to get it. These are all sources of self-induced stress. Here are some others. Not allowing yourself to relax, or worse yet, feeling guilty when you do relax, as many have told me, is possibly the most common self-induced stressor of all. The inability or unwillingness to tolerate frustration or discomfort and expecting life to be totally problem-free, or what we call time urgency or hurry sickness, not only causes excessive amounts of stress, but also tends to dilute the quality of your enjoyment of life on a daily basis. Being overextended to the point where you often or always feel overwhelmed. Being involved in too many projects with difficult or impossible deadlines. And don't forget that compulsion to work while neglecting all other areas of your life that are important to you. Also, worrying about situations that you can't change or control. Being perfectionistic and overly self-critical by expecting too much of yourself and not allowing yourself much of any margin of error. And if you do that, perhaps you convey that attitude to others around you, which could cause even more problems. Or perhaps you expect other people around you to provide you with a sense of comfort and security instead of relying on yourself to fulfill that most basic need. You could also be tending to compare yourself with others and feel under a tremendous amount of stress when that invalid comparison of your insides versus someone else's outsides leaves you feeling inadequate or that you've come up short. Do you feel powerless to bring your life under your own control or make the assumption that other people around you will know what you're thinking, feeling, and what you want from them instead of making yourself clear or asking for what you want? And finally, being pessimistic and simply expecting the worst out of life may for you be a self-induced stressor. These are all merely common life attitudes that you can see act to bring stress onto yourself. Now, I'm not going to tell you to give them all up. I only ask that you recognize them and choose them consciously or make your own decision to give them up as we go along. And if you decide to give them up, do it only because you acknowledge that it's in your own ultimate best interest to do so. Before going any further, I'd like you to take a few moments to think about just what stressors now are present in your life. List them on a piece of paper. Be as thorough as you possibly can be. And if necessary, go back and re-listen to the last few minutes of this tape in order to further digest some of the more common ones. But when making your list, Pay closest attention to the more unique ones that you recognize as characterizing your life right now, and be as specific as possible. Turn off the tape and do this now, then turn the tape back on when you're ready to continue. Now, I'd also like you to think about areas of your life that can use some attention right now. Things that may be objects of worry for you, or be ongoing sources of stress. Perhaps there are things that preoccupy, bother, or concern you, but you're trying unsuccessfully to ignore the effect they have on you. Maybe you're concerned about some health problem you've been ignoring, or about your marriage or love relationship, or one that's ended. Perhaps there's a problem with one or more of your children, or with your parents, or some other important person in your life. How are things going with respect to your career? Are you feeling insecure in that area or unappreciated? Are you overworked or underutilized? Either thing can be felt as stress. Do you believe that your life is going in a direction that's not the one you would choose for yourself, yet you feel at a loss for developing a new game plan? Are you aware of something that's missing in your life that you feel very much at a loss for? Or are there some factors in your life that you would clearly like to eliminate? Are finances creating a major burden for you? Are you having fun in your life? Are you sleeping and eating properly? Are you exercising enough? Is there an addiction or concern about drugs, alcohol, or tobacco that's troubling you? Are you having difficulty making decisions or sticking to those decisions that you do make and following through with them? How's your self-image and self-confidence? Are you living your life according to your values or according to the values of someone else? Are you in the process of grieving over the death of a loved one? Are you in the midst of handling legal difficulties that have you under a great deal of pressure? You may want to ponder some of these additional items and then add to your list of stressors as appropriate. And if so, then turn the tape off and do this now, then turn it back on when you're ready to continue. While it's obviously beyond the scope of this program to address every one of these potential problems in the depth that each one deserves, an important first step is to recognize what problems exist, that is, what might be your main sources of stress, and then put them on the front burner as we talk about numerous ways to address and resolve them throughout this program. I asked you a few moments ago if you knew when it's in your best interest to recognize and give up your stressful attitudes, habits, and aspects of your lifestyle. Let me answer that question by describing to you the signs or symptoms of distress, which, remember, is the excess amount of stress over and above that which you're coping with or handling well. So consider these signs of distress as warning signals that there's more stress in your system than you may be able to manage. Anxiety, depression, and an excessive amount of anger and hostility. Tension headaches, backaches, tics, muscle spasms, migraine headaches, abdominal pains, ulcers, colitis, and other bowel disorders, tachycardia or rapid heartbeat, and other cardiovascular symptoms, and high blood pressure. Are you experiencing pounding of the heart, rapid pulse, frequent illness, persistent or prolonged fatigue, nail biting, the inability to concentrate, increased use of alcohol, drugs, or tobacco, hunger for sweets, speech difficulties, indigestion, lack of appetite, grinding of your teeth, unexplained aches and pains such as those in the neck, shoulders, or lower back? A mood of general irritability and accident proneness may also be signs of distress as well. Distress could also be the source of nervousness, insomnia, inattentiveness, tightness of the chest, boredom, an inability to slow down or feeling that your life is out of control. In addition, allergies, sexual difficulties such as inhibited or lack of sexual desire, and concentration difficulties are all highly correlated to distress. As you may have gathered, sometimes distress can be a circular thing. For example, if you're under a lot of distress, you can be neglecting your most important relationships, and the result of that neglect could be causing you even more distress. Furthermore, your inability to handle life's dilemmas may be something for which you're putting yourself down. Dissatisfaction with yourself is highly correlated to both anxiety and depression, which of course are often symptoms of distress. Sometimes stress or distress is confused with burnout. Although the symptoms are similar, usually burnout refers to a specific area of your life, such as your job or marriage. In that case, sometimes a major change of job, career, or lifestyle is indicated, or perhaps a transition within the system in which you're working, or a good restful vacation is the answer, or at least part of the answer. You can be pretty sure that it's burnout when you feel a marked change in your mood for the better as soon as you're out of the environment associated with your feelings of burnout. Burnout also applies to relationships such as marriage. Love relationships that are stormy can certainly contribute a great deal of stress to every area of your life. But relationships that are characterized by distance or indifference, especially when they were once fulfilling, have often succumbed to burnout. If this is the case, and your relationship is one that you want to save, it's important that you begin communicating with your partner about this immediately. First, it's important to talk about what you each see happening. Next, see if you can together recapture how things were during better times when you first got together. Then try to work as a team to recreate that climate so that those sparks you once had can be reactivated if possible. You may also want to consult one of our programs that's designed to help you evaluate your relationship. Our program, Can This Relationship Be Saved?, is the specific one that will help you to determine whether your relationship situation is reversible. You may also find some of our other programs, such as Keeping Passion Alive and How to Develop the Ingredients for Staying Together, to be helpful. However, there is one simple truism about burnout. That is, in order to burn out, you have to have been on fire at one time. In other words, the people most susceptible to burnout are often those who had the highest degree of passion toward whatever it is they feel burnout about now. Relationships that burn out are often the ones that were at one time quite fulfilling, but somehow became neglected. At work, it's usually those who approach their career activities with the most enthusiasm who suffer burnout when there's a sense of chronic frustration or lack of appreciation on the job. Sometimes trying harder isn't what works, but rather trying a bit softer. Recognize the limitations of your job, relationship, or other source of burnout, and don't look for things that are beyond it. And most importantly, try to shift your thinking to give yourself more credit for what you've done rather than self-blame for what you believe you haven't. As we continue through this program, you'll find that many of the stress management techniques I'll give you apply to burnout as well as other more generalized forms of stress and distress. So how do we prevent stress from becoming distress? The answer lies in learning some new attitudes and some new habits that will result in a healthier, more stress-free, and hopefully distress-less lifestyle. Let's look at these one at a time. Is having it all something you're trying to accomplish? If so, can you truthfully say that you've ever met a person who's had it all? I certainly haven't. Remember the secret that practically all high achievers who manage not to get distressed seem to know, that with hard work and determination, you can have practically anything you want, but not everything you want. when you make having it all a demand or your highest priority, you make yourself a perfect candidate for virtually all of the symptoms of stress, distress, and burnout we've discussed so far. In addition to pushing yourself way too hard to achieve what is possibly an impossible mission, chances are your self-esteem will suffer. You may perceive as a failure your inability to reach this unreachable goal of having it all. It's possible that whatever it is that you do accomplish, instead of enjoying the fruits of your hard-earned labor, you negate whatever progress you've already made by focusing on whatever it is you haven't yet achieved. So the key is to be satisfied with what you do have at one level while striving for those additional things that you want at another level, yet giving yourself permission to come up short sometimes. Think of this as keeping your goals realistic and allowing yourself to experience satisfaction with what you have before pushing yourself too hard for what you don't have. After all, what's the struggle all about anyway? This could mean paying special attention to balancing whatever it is that you consider success with those things that you find will bring you happiness. Is success what you're after, or is it happiness? Probably your answer to that question is simply both. But will success necessarily lead to happiness? And what about when success and happiness conflict, such as when something you're trying to accomplish in your career can only occur at the expense of important relationships in your personal life? So I'd like you now to ask yourself some questions and take note of the answers that come up for you. What do you most want to have in your life? That is, what are your sights now set on? And how will you know when you'll have it? What is it you'll need to do, or what steps will you have to take in order to accomplish what you've identified? And what are you willing to give up in order to get there? Think about some of these questions as they relate both to your specific goals and to the overall climate of your life. You could focus on one aspect of your life, one goal, or several right now. Put your thoughts on paper. If this process is new to you, now is a great time to begin. You may want to turn off the tape and do this now, then turn it back on when you're ready to continue. Is your life on the track that you want it to be taking? And is it going in the direction that you want it to be going? Have you identified one or two minor things that need to be shuffled around? Or a major change or two that needs to be addressed regarding your goals and your overall philosophy of life? Only you can determine these things, and only you can decide the direction that will make your life one that's enjoyable versus one that's characterized by the type of stresses and distress you'd be much better off without. If you really allow yourself to address these issues with the intensity they deserve, this could mean putting some things off, such as having a child or relocating for advancement, or just plain giving yourself a break from being under the constant pressure of climbing the ladder of success. When you tell yourself that you must succeed in order to be a worthwhile person, chances are you're putting success above happiness. And after all, isn't happiness the purpose of success in the first place? As a psychologist who for many years has helped scores of people with this very dilemma, it's never ceased to amaze me how common it is to lose sight of that perspective entirely. Have you ever wondered why something that's very stressful for one person is often not stressful at all for someone else? For example, I was recently with a group of people who were racing to catch a train. All of us were coming from the same place, and due to circumstances beyond our control, we were not sure we were going to make it on time. We were running frantically, and just as we got to the train, it pulled away. One person yelled furiously at the train to stop and reverse itself, an obvious impossibility, but was so visibly upset that the other bystanders felt a need to clear the area. Another member of our group said, "Okay, that's that. Another train comes in an hour. Maybe this will give us an opportunity to get some lunch." The second person was not upset at all. And other members of our group, including myself, had reactions that fell somewhere in between the first two. Now, there was one event that occurred for all of us, the missing of a train, yet there were some extremely different reactions. How is this so? Well, the answer lies in what each of us told ourselves about that particular event, missing the train. The first individual told himself that it was awful and horrible to have missed this train, and acted as if he hadn't merely missed a train that would cost him an hour out of his life, but acted as though he were being thrust into a life or death situation. He was under so much stress that it took several minutes to calm him down. On the other hand, the calm individual told himself, "I did whatever I could to make the train, but I missed the train. I can't help it, and so there's no sense getting upset about it." In other words, he recognized that he had a choice. He could either become upset about it, or he could let it go, enjoy lunch, catch the next train, and deal with the consequences of being an hour late when the time came. If you stop and think about it, practically all of our feelings are determined by what we tell ourselves about those life events and circumstances that produce those feelings. Dr. Albert Ellis, founder of Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, has developed an extremely simple concept to put this into perspective that almost anyone can follow. What Dr. Ellis's theory illustrates is that by changing what it is that you tell yourself about virtually anything that occurs, you can change your emotional response to it. We can easily see how this happened in the example of different people missing the same train. How about a boss whom you believe gets you angry? Is it the boss who produces that emotion of anger in you? Or is it you telling yourself, "I can't stand this person and the way I'm being treated"? Or do you tell yourself, "This person should not exist"? But if that's what you tell yourself, and your boss does exist, your frustration becomes felt as anger, stress, and if unchallenged, ultimately distress. How about when you get down on yourself? For example, if you were to fail an exam and became depressed, was your depression caused by your failure to pass the exam, or by the behavior of the examiner? Or is it you telling yourself, "I should have done much better," or "I'm less of a person because I didn't do better"? By changing your self-talk to something more appropriate and realistic, such as, "Although I didn't do as well as I wished I could, it's in my own interest to accept the reality that I failed the test, to think about how I can do better next time by learning from the mistakes I made this time and stop berating myself, because the additional upset is going to serve me no purpose." It certainly won't make one bit of difference on my test score, and it will only produce an attitude in which I needlessly put myself down. Furthermore, failing this test makes absolutely no statement whatsoever about my intelligence level or any other aspect of my life or me as a person. How about if you're so overly anxious about making a presentation that the quality of your presentation suffers? Is it the presentation that's making you anxious, or is it what you're telling yourself about the presentation? Things such as, "If I don't do this perfectly well, I'm incompetent," or "Others will think less of me and this would be awful," etc., etc. You get the idea. Some of the common beliefs practically all of us can recognize and which can cause emotional upset are described by Dr. Albert Ellis and include the belief that it's essential to be loved and approved of, that you must be thoroughly competent, adequate, and achieving in all possible respects, that others should treat you the way you want to be treated, or they're automatically no good, that when things don't go your way, it's terrible and you should not be able to stand it, that you must continue to be controlled by earlier events in your life, such as an unhappy childhood or a bad marriage, and that the world should be easy and full of fairness rather than unjust, and of course any variation of that must automatically become a source of constant upset. Take a moment or two to identify some of the things you characteristically tell yourself which contribute to your level of distress. You may want to turn the tape off and do this now, then turn it back on when you're ready to continue. When these beliefs or self-sentences come up for you, and the result is a predictable variety of negative feelings which lead to stress and distress, challenge them. Remind yourself that you have a choice as to what your response will be. It no longer has to be an automatic and stressful one. With a bit of practice, you can quickly bring this response under your control to one that's much less stressful. Some of our other programs, such as Overcoming Your Depression, Overcoming Your Anxiety, and Overcoming Your Anger, get into this crucial concept in much more depth. For many years, we've known about the Type A personality. Type A behavior is found in people who are hard-driven, time-pressured, and overly aggressive. It's this group who was first shown to have an increased risk of heart disease due to stress. Anger and cynicism are traits of the type A personality that have been most correlated to heart disease. Dr. Robert Elliott, a researcher in the area of stress medicine, has identified an even more dangerous trait he refers to as being a hot reactor. This is both on a psychological level, such as our friend who overreacted to missing the train, and on a physiological level, where the body's reaction to stressful events leads to a rapid rise in blood pressure. This hot reactor trait is also highly correlated with heart disease and even sudden death. What's important here to remember is that these reactions have been shown time and time again to do a lot more harm to our entire system than they could ever possibly be worth. So learning the art of accepting those things you cannot change while changing what it is that you can, in some people, literally can be the difference between life and death. Here are some other considerations and measures that can be much better used for prevention before they've caused problems, rather than as corrective ones after they've taken the kind of toll on you that they're capable of taking. Is your schedule so tight that you might be suffering from what we call hurry sickness, where you're always on to the next thing before you finish the last thing with very little time in between? To avoid the impatience of hurry sickness, allow for delays. Give yourself some slack in your schedule and make it a point to enjoy those times when you need to wait as a gift of time. I found it very useful to always have a pencil and paper with me so that I can jot down thoughts and ideas whenever I'm someplace where I have to wait. Often, I use the time to read or just be with my own thoughts. Perhaps this may involve working toward enjoying your own company. If you can give yourself this gift, I can practically guarantee you that solitude will become one of your most favorite ways to spend time. Set priorities wisely and consider long-term versus short-term consequences. This can apply when taking on new projects as well as when taking on an attitude of aggravation towards something which in reality is meaningless. You can then eliminate spending your time with circumstances or individuals that are ultimately time wasters. If your time is tight, a great habit could be to evaluate how meaningful whatever it is you're considering becoming engaged in will be to you in 1, 2, or 3 years. Use this test to help you to set priorities, and you'll almost certainly become more efficient while being easier on yourself. Does the project or issue really matter? Will it ultimately make your life easier or harder? Sometimes, you may need to take a step back a bit and look at it objectively. If this is difficult for you, do it as though you were advising someone else. If you find that your stress won't be reduced, or long-term meaning will not be gained from whatever it is that you're thinking about becoming involved in, just say no. If saying no is something that you feel guilty about, remember, guilt is just one of those self-defeating attitudes that you manufacture inside yourself, especially when you've done nothing wrong. Ask yourself why you should feel guilty when all you've really done was to save yourself from some of that potentially lethal distress. With a little practice, you'll learn to bypass that guilt and be much more conserving and time-protective. Also, it's conceivable that when you say yes to something that you really wished you had said no to or could say no to, you become angry at yourself. If this is the case, ask yourself, which is your point of vulnerability? Being angry at yourself for saying yes when you wanted to say no, or having someone else give you an angry reaction for saying no? Or even more realistically, the momentary discomfort of turning someone or something down. What is it that you fear? Try reaching out to people around you when you're feeling stressed. Don't get hung up on the notion that asking for help or support from others is a sign of weakness. For example, if you're experiencing an economic crisis, such as one caused by sudden unemployment, a large unexpected expense, a disability, or a major financial loss, remember that families who are able to be there for each other, who are able to stay together throughout the crisis, who can avoid blaming themselves or each other, no matter how tempting it may be, will manage to get through a crisis with the least amount of distress and come out stronger for it, rather than weaker. I highly recommend that you start keeping a diary of your stressful reactions. Include your negative feelings such as anger, anxiety, depression, and guilt. Also, include in it all the W's, who, what, when, where, and why, about whatever it is that's upsetting you or that you find difficult to handle. It's often helpful if there's someone close to you who cares and who you can talk it over with. Sometimes just breaking your isolation can have a profound effect. But at the same time, remember to avoid those people who bring you down even more when you're stressed out. Make a list of things you feel good about, and that can help you to feel good. And if you're under the gun, reach for this list so that you can find some positive diversions. A little later in the program, we'll talk about ways to relax. But you know what those things are that you enjoy. Hobbies, playing golf, tennis or another sport, getting a massage, going to your favorite museum, listening to your favorite music, calling a friend you may not speak to often but whom you feel relaxed and good about talking to, taking a sailing trip, playing Scrabble, going for a long walk at some place that has a pleasing environment such as an ocean, lake or wooded area. Remember to fall back on those things when you need them the most. Make effective use of your time by organizing your activities. Try to make your routine as unstressful as possible, anticipating that unexpected things will come up that will add stress. To have a routine schedule that by definition is stressful only invites more stress than you can manage, and of course, that then automatically becomes distress. Chances are, you can't solve all your problems at once. So focus on what you can effectively do now. A good way of doing this is to make it a point to address issues that will inevitably come up at another time when you're not feeling overly bothered by them. That way, your thinking will probably be much clearer than when you're overwhelmed or in crisis, and you'll be able to do much more effective problem solving. Also, get enough sleep. And take vacations regularly. Don't fall into the trap of thinking you're indispensable. No one is. Sometimes, by temporarily changing your environment, your entire outlook can change as well. Short-term solutions, such as the use of drugs or alcohol, can sometimes make you temporarily feel better, but remember they're not without their side effects and possibility of addiction. Ways of natural relaxation can be much more effective and a whole lot safer. Of course, there are times when prescribed medication is necessary, but self-medicating through drug and alcohol abuse usually causes infinitely more problems than it solves. A complete program of stress management also involves exercise and proper nutrition. The type and amount of exercise you do is a highly individual matter. But 20 to 30 minutes three times per week of an aerobic type exercise where you bring your pulse or heart rate up to about 75% of your maximum, which is 220 beats per minute minus your age, is the basic recommendation. This is thought to be the minimum amount for good cardiovascular conditioning. For example, if you're 40 years of age, 220 less 40 would be 180. 60% of 180 is 108, and 75% of 180 is 135. Your training level is therefore the range between 108 and 135 beats per minute. However, if you've been physically inactive, before beginning any exercise program, please have a checkup and exercise only with the knowledge of a physician familiar with your physical condition. A physical fitness program should never be a crash program. For best results, it needs to be a staple in your life. The best kind of exercise is a varied program which includes whatever you enjoy the most, whether it be walking, running, biking, swimming, taking an aerobics class, or using a treadmill or some other piece of exercise equipment that will give you an aerobic effect. This can be done at home or in a gym. Other activities might include tennis, racquetball, or skipping rope. Always be sure to warm up first. That is to stretch and take a few minutes to get to the low end of your target range and then at least 5 minutes to cool down, which means to bring your pulse rate back to normal. And stretch again before resuming other activities. When done properly, by warming up, exercising, and cooling down, the benefits of regular exercise are universally recognized. Eating correctly, by eliminating or moderating your use of sugar, caffeine, preservatives, artificial flavorings, red meat, highly processed foods, and products containing fat, is extremely effective in increasing your immunity to distress. The information and resources for proper dieting, whether it be for weight control or simply to maintain optimal health, are vast. I urge you to take advantage of these resources and, like exercise, make proper nutrition a permanent part of your life. Arguably, the most important aspect of good stress management is to practice relaxation. In a few minutes, I'll give you several methods of doing this. But first, be aware of some other factors that will go a long way toward helping you to manage your stress and making it work for you. Try to build fun into your daily schedule, at work as well as at home. If this is not possible, something's wrong. Perhaps you're not in the kind of environment you need to be in order to have the happy life you're searching for. Perhaps you now need to be aware of what it is that you had better put into your life, or what would be best to eliminate. If one of your problems is that you spend a lot of time worrying, try this. When you start having a worrisome thought, jot it down and then let go of it. Some people find it quite helpful to schedule a half hour every week or so to sit down and just simply concentrate on those worry items they noted all week. As absurd as this may sound, for many, this is a way to let go of the tendency to allow worrisome thoughts to constantly preoccupy them. Of course, you can also do yourself a great deal of good by addressing those very things that you worry about in a rational problem-solving mode. Next, and as a way of beginning that problem-solving process, I'd like you to address all of those sources of stress that you listed earlier in this program. Make a plan of attack for each one. Determine what your situation would be like if that stressor were cut down to size or eliminated. Then ask yourself, what would it take to resolve that stressor? Pay attention to what you need to address internally by looking at your attitude and how you view each stressor, as well as your external items. Next, for each specific item on your list, identify what specifically needs to be changed, both within yourself as well as in your environment, and what needs to be accepted rather than changed in order to stop it from being a stressor. Pay special attention to the question of how you plan to go about making the changes or reaching that level of acceptance you need to achieve to reduce your stress. Perhaps your next step involves some new affirmations or choosing some new attitudes that would be much healthier for you to adopt. You may want to take an item or two on your list of stressors and work on both the questions related to them and the directions you'd like to take these stressors. This, like physical exercise, is an ongoing process that needs to be done each time life puts those sources of stress in your path. Once again, be especially mindful of the nature of your stress-producing activities. When you can do that, chances are the alternatives will become obvious. For example, you may need to consciously give yourself permission to be less busy or happier in some way, even if being so is not necessarily in the best interest of someone else close to you. By the same token, it's crucial to accept your own fallibility, and thus put what others think of you as secondary to what you think of yourself and what will ultimately give you pleasure and peace. And as much as people may try to get you to take their negativity personally, don't fall for it. You have the power to rise above taking things personally, or whatever you choose to rise above for that matter. And to the degree that you'll use this power, you'll stay much more level-headed and less distressed. And even more important, much of your life will fall in place if only you don't take yourself too seriously either. But even if you don't do any of these things that I've mentioned on this program, accept yourself for the person you are anyway. Your own self-acceptance is the greatest weapon there is against distress. What follows now is a series of exercises which you can use practically any time and anywhere in order to reduce your stress right on the spot. Try them all. That's the only way to discover which ones work best for you. And once you know what works best, make their use a habit or a regular part of your daily life. The benefits will immediately become apparent. They all have as a major purpose to prevent your stressors from becoming sources of distress. In other words, empowering you to manage or take charge of your stress rather than allowing your stress to manage you. The first exercise that I'd like you to try involves just doing some very basic breathing. The way we breathe often reflects and contributes to the way we feel. You may have noticed that when you're feeling stressed, your breathing often becomes shallow and confined to your upper chest. When this happens, your shallow breathing can actually contribute to the tension that you feel. By contrast, notice how you breathe just before you fall asleep or when you first wake up in the morning. At those times when you're in a state of relaxation, chances are you breathe slowly and deeply into your abdominal area. So when you find yourself stressed out, and you can just about always recognize your breathing is becoming shallow, the task is to consciously deepen it. Put your finger on the area of your abdomen approximately 2 inches below your navel. Keep your finger there, and when we begin this breathing exercise, let your breath go down to where your finger is. Hold it for a second or two, and then exhale completely. Let's do it together. Breathe deeply, and exhale completely. Come on, exhale a little more. Breathe, exhale a little more. Breathe, exhale more. Breathe, exhale a little more. Breathe, exhale, breathe, exhale, breathe, exhale. Notice how differently you feel when you consciously deepen your breathing, and that only took a few seconds. For another variation of this exercise, simply close your eyes if possible, or if you can't close your eyes right now, leave them open and think the word calm as you breathe in, and think the phrase let go as you breathe out. But again, breathe down to that spot you've identified 2 inches below your navel. We'll do it 5 times together. Breathe in, think calm. Exhale and let go. Breathe calm. Exhale and let go. Calm. Let go. Calm. Let go. Calm. Let go. Once again, be aware of how you're feeling right now. This is an exercise that you can do in a minute or less at practically any time at all when you're feeling stress, anxiety, nervousness, or tension. You can do it with your eyes open or closed. But no matter how you do it, the key is to breathe deeply and to exhale just as thoroughly. A moment ago, I mentioned that the times when you're probably feeling the most relaxed are just at the moment when you awaken in the morning and just before you go to sleep at night. That's because during those periods of time, you're in what's called an alpha state, even if it's only for a second or two. An alpha state is determined by our brainwave pattern and essentially represents the period in between sleep and an awake state. Studies have shown that when we're in alpha, we're most relaxed. One way to achieve an alpha state is by practicing meditation. And meditation is simply a mind-expanding exercise, that is where you allow your mind to break loose from the constraints that are put on it by the trials and tribulations of everyday life. I see its main purpose as a wonderful state of mind to alleviate stress. Studies have also shown that those who meditate need less sleep and also have more available energy. So it's also time effective. Other studies have shown that in addition, it can have a positive effect on your blood pressure and heart rate. Meditation can be done for any period of time, but most people who build it into their daily routine meditate once or twice a day for 20 minutes. However, you can also meditate for 1 to 5 minutes, or take as long or as short a period as you'd like. Here's one basic meditation method. Sit in a chair as comfortably as possible. It's perfectly okay to lie down when you meditate, except that many people find that when they meditate lying down, they tend to fall asleep. Meditation does not require any fancy lotus positions or any kind of special environment, wearing apparel or anything else. Just sit comfortably and close your eyes. The ultimate goal of meditation is realized when you're fully awake but not experiencing thoughts. Simply allow yourself to breathe naturally and easily. The most basic meditation method is to think in as you inhale and out as you exhale. Just let any other thoughts that come to you simply pass by. That is, merely let them go in one ear and out the other. I'll have more suggestions for dealing with unwanted thoughts while meditating a little later. Another variation on this theme is to let your eyes gently close and then look upward with your eyes closed, as though imagining a third eye. The third eye refers to that spot above and between your eyes that would form a triangle in the midpoint between your eyes and about 1 inch up on your forehead. You may want to put your index finger there now to locate that spot. Do some breathing and just try focusing your mind on that spot we call the third eye. If you're getting distracted, another way to handle it is to count each breath as you exhale. That is, inhale, and then as you exhale, count one. Inhale, exhale, two. Inhale, exhale, three. Inhale, exhale, four. Do that up to 10, and then begin again with one. If you lose count, simply start again at one. But let your conscious mind focus on not losing count. This is an excellent way to block the recurrence of extraneous thoughts. If you lose count or stop counting altogether and your mind becomes just a peaceful blank, then that's even better. In that case, let your mind go off on whatever tangent it wants, as long as it's doing so effortlessly. With some practice, you'll find a way of meditating that works for you, as long as you do it on a consistent basis. Next, I'd like to give you a relaxation exercise that you can try right now just to learn the method. After we've done this together, I'll tell you some other variations you could put into it to help you to melt your stress away in practically no time at all. But if you're driving in a car right now, come back to this exercise when you can safely give it your full attention. Sit back and close your eyes. Observe how you're breathing right now, but without doing anything to alter your breath. Now, very slowly and effortlessly, let your breathing get a little bit deeper. And as your breathing gets deeper, notice yourself relaxing. Now, I'd like you to visualize an escalator. This escalator is just gently and effortlessly moving in a downward direction. As you get onto this escalator, you fall backwards into what feels like a very soft pillow. But in essence, it's like a cloud that's drifting downward very slowly. And the farther it moves down, the more relaxed you feel. Now I'm going to count backwards from 10 to 1. And at the count of 1, you'll feel completely at peace and totally relaxed. Ten, relaxing. Nine, relaxing more. Eight, with each count, you're feeling more relaxed, better and better. Seven, it's a beautiful feeling. Six, remember when we get down to one, you'll be totally and completely relaxed. Five, drifting more. 4, relaxing. 3, 2, 1. You're now completely and totally relaxed. You feel feel safe, warm, and peaceful. And you're in a place right now where you can stay for as long or as short a period of time as you'd like. You may want to turn the tape off now and stay for a while, and then turn the tape back on when you're ready to come back. And when you're ready to come back to the room, to come back to normal, I will count from 1 to 5, and at the count of 5, you'll be totally and completely back in the room, feeling better than you have in a long time, awake, aware, and totally alert. You'll also recognize that this frame of mind is something you can achieve anytime you sit comfortably, close your eyes, and count backwards from 10 to 1. And to come back up, you simply count forward from 1 to 5. We're going to come up now, remembering that this is a place you can return to anytime you choose. 1. Coming up now. 2. Feeling more and more energized. 3. Eyes just starting to open. 4. Feeling just about back. 5. Now you're completely back in the room. If you're not feeling ready to continue right now, simply turn off the tape and come back to it when you're ready to continue. There are many variations that you can do with breathing and counting. Once again, I urge you to discover what works best for you. When you get to that state of relaxation, you could stay for any period of time you choose. But here are a few additional points about these states of relaxation that I've talked about. If you're bothered by thoughts you believe are important while trying to meditate or while doing a relaxation exercise, and you're troubled by the idea that you may forget your thought, simply open your eyes, write your thought or thoughts down, and then let them go. These thoughts will be there on paper after you finish the exercise or when you need them. If you're concerned about time, feel free to open your eyes and check the time whenever you'd like. Then simply close your eyes and resume the meditation or relaxation exercise. Also, if you're interrupted while doing one of these exercises, there's no reason why you can't resume the exercise after you've handled the interruption. If this is not possible, there are no negative effects to abruptly ending a meditation or relaxation exercise. It's just not quite as comforting as coming out of it slowly. Most people find it helpful just to relax quietly for a moment or two after the exercise or meditation as a way of making the transition. When you're in a relaxed state, you can also choose to do some visualization. This simply involves fixing your conscious mind on an image of your choosing. For example, I asked you a moment ago to visualize an escalator, and probably an escalator of the type you see in a department store, hotel, or an office building is what came to mind. But you can also visualize a concept like happiness and peace of mind. If you were to do this, you would imagine what your life would be like if you were completely and totally happy, and you had the total amount of peace of mind and were able to let yourself be in that place for the period of time you've chosen to stay in your relaxed frame of mind. You can also visualize a completely safe place, such as your own private sanctuary, which has all the ingredients you need to feel totally stress-free. Or, if you're feeling tense, you can imagine a piece of tight and twisted rope, and then let that be a metaphor for the way you're feeling. And then imagine the rope unknotting and untwisting and turning into a peaceful, calm scene like a meadow, ocean, or woods. If you're feeling tension in your body or some part of it, tense it up some more, then let go and visualize that bodily tension just melting away. Concentrate on the tense spots first. Tense it up or tighten it more, then let go. Again, and let go. Once more, and then let go. Then tense up your entire body, and again, let go. Do this several times, and don't forget to visualize that tension just leaving, and note how much better you feel. If you're feeling tense about a project, you can imagine the project being done and how nicely that will feel. Then imagine just what your life would be like if the project were done totally to your satisfaction. Or if you're upset about a job search, you can visualize yourself getting the perfect job, then allow yourself to experience that peace of mind you would have once your stressful job search or other situation is over. If you're troubled by a particular individual, you can imagine that individual looking silly and unthreatening, or perhaps turning into a gaseous substance and blowing away. These are all within your power to do any time you choose to do them. So as you can see, managing your stress is clearly within your power if you become totally committed to managing it. The exercises that I've presented in this program are like any other exercise. The extent to which you commit yourself to do them is the extent to which you'll see immeasurable benefits. I hope you found and continue to find this program helpful in understanding and managing your stress, with the result that you can make your stress work for you and that the quality of your life will ultimately improve. Because remember, once you've learned to truly manage your stress, when stressors come up, they no longer have to be a threat. You can consider them friends, clues that something in your life needs to be looked at or changed. And remember, stress management is a lifelong process. So go back through this program as often as you need to in order to zero in on the areas with which you can still use some help. And please let us know how you're doing. I'm very concerned about your progress and welcome any comments about this program or how it's affected you. If I can be of any assistance to you with respect to resources that can further help you, feel free to call or write me. I'm Dr. Michael Broder, wishing you good luck and good health.